This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The pandemic has created some unanticipated consequences for political campaigns, and they're not all bad.
There's been a particular rise in turnout among what we would call marginalized voters. People that would never be able to participate in political rallies are now being included.
Hear more on pandemic politics from ISU professor Carrie Melita. Plus, Heartland Community College enrollment is down, and down more for African Americans and other minorities. It's a mystery how much the governor's new order on masks will be enforced. And plagues, pandemics, and people, it's a new course offered at Illinois State University. That and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. McLean County health officials have announced a new single-day record of 51 new coronavirus cases today, marking the third time in the last week the county has set a new daily record for cases. More than half of them involve young people. 26 of the cases are from people ages 10 to 19, and 13 include people in their 20s. One case involves a child under the age of 10. Illinois State University says at least 7 students and 8 faculty and staff have tested positive for COVID-19 so far this month, and more are expected. Those 7 students were all tested on campus Monday or before. Results from Tuesday and today are not yet available. Those cases plus others reported over the summer break mean at least 18 students have contracted COVID-19 to date. Illinois State University administrators say they plan to ramp up talks with the University of Illinois about a quick, cheap coronavirus test just approved by the federal government. U of I chemistry professor Paul Hergenrother and a research team developed the test that uses saliva instead of nasal swabs. He says it avoids supply chain bottlenecks on things like the swabs and protective gear.
We knew that we needed such a test at a university of this size, that we needed something that was very, very convenient.
The U of I's Urbana campus has the ability to run 10,000 tests a day to support the twice-a-week testing required for all on that campus. An ISU spokesperson says it may take time to create lab space to handle tests of students in normal. Hergenrother says everything is open source and available for other labs. Illinois Wesleyan University says 10 students who live in off-campus housing have tested positive for coronavirus at that institution. They live in a variety of places, not just one. IWU says many did not have symptoms. IWU says the outbreak comes from off-campus social gatherings at which students did not use masks or socially distance. That is a violation of university policy. Authorities say one man is dead after apparently becoming trapped under a large mower in the YWCA McLean County parking lot this morning. The incident happened around 8 a.m. just off Hershey Road on Bloomington's east side. The coroner's office had been called to the scene. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Governor J.B. Pritzker's new emergency mask order puts the burden of enforcement on businesses, schools, and daycares. They can now be fined or even criminally charged if they don't make sure customers and employees mask up. Eric Stock reports it's not clear how much it will be enforced.
Heather Stiles owns Adrian's Shoes in Bloomington. It's a small store in a strip mall, so keeping social distance can be a challenge.
We have some, on occasions, had to even limit the number of customers that we have in the store at one time. So things have been relatively just steady, though, so we haven't had to address that.
Stiles says her business already enforces the mandate, but she doesn't like the possibility she will be held responsible if someone refuses.
That does bother me as being a business owner in Illinois. I think the consumer has to have some accountability as well.
County prosecutors have the final say in deciding charges and fines. McLean County State's Attorney Don Knapp says his office hasn't taken any action against individuals or businesses. over masks. He says his office would consider charges if police or health officials file reports. According to the governor's order, a first offense leads to a warning. On a second offense, the government can order everyone out of a business if someone inside is creating a health risk. If that doesn't work, they can fine a business up to $2,500. Officials in McLean County say they hesitate to take a punitive approach. Police Chief in Normal Rick Bleichner says his department occasionally gets calls about people not wearing a mask in public.
We're not going to be rushing out and issuing citations on this. That's not our intent. So based on what we've seen to this point, why would we? We've had cooperation from the businesses at this point when we work with them between us and the health department. It seemed to have been a very productive approach.
Police relay complaints to the McLean County Health Department. Administrator Jessica McKnight has said from the beginning her office prefers education versus enforcement.
I anticipate that we will probably receive more complaints now that this has been public and people know that there is a method that they can take to voice those complaints about masking, but we're going to follow the same due process procedures that we always did.
McKnight says education is usually effective. Businesses generally cooperate after a follow-up. She says the county's COVID positivity rates and hospitalizations are lower than in many other areas in the state. Governor Pritzker says he wants more teeth in the statewide mask ordinance because some local governments did not take it seriously as COVID numbers rose. During a recent stop in Bloomington, the governor said as long as businesses make a good faith effort, the ordinance will not be punitive.
Nobody's asking a business owner to confront that person or a worker to confront that person and have to have an argument with that person. We're simply asking you to make reasonable efforts. That includes putting a mask, a sign up that says, no mask, no service, might be an example.
Pritzker argues tough mask enforcement helps businesses stay even because the ones who play by the rules can lose customers to businesses that don't. Any physical contact with a store employee who enforces a mask ordinance is now a felony. What can a business do when someone refuses to wear a mask? Attorney Lorna Geiler recently told McLean County business owners they can ban anyone from their store for not wearing a mask as long as they offer a reasonable accommodation.
If it's a customer who wants to go down the aisles of the Target without a mask on, we can say, no, you simply can't do that. Here's the accommodation we can offer you. Give us your list.
The time might come when a business owner could report a mask violator. The McLean County Board of Health plans to talk to Bloomington and Normal city officials about creating a mask ordinance to fine anyone not wearing a mask in public. Health Board member Hannah Eisner says some may think it's unenforceable or heavy-handed or a money grab for a city. She says it doesn't have to be any of those things. It can simply be another way to stress the value of protecting those around you.
A lot of this is that we trust that there's common sense application of this by not having vigilantes out there to catch people not wearing masks. That it's generally a complaint-driven system.
Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner says he supports mask enforcement, but says it doesn't work if one city does it and others around them don't.
It is the type of thing that, generally speaking, is better done on a regional, broader basis, like at the state level. That doesn't mean I would be opposed to it. It's just I'd like to see what that might look like.
Renner says his biggest concern is allowing a COVID resurgence that leads to another broad shutdown. I'm Eric Stock.
The most recent data from the state puts McLean County's rate of new coronavirus cases in a warning area. The county recently set a 7-day record with 131 new cases. The positivity rate is still below warning guidelines. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. At this moment, it's hard to see beyond COVID-19 and what life will be like when it's no longer the most pressing matter in front of us. Illinois State University professor and archaeologist Abigail Stone sees the pandemic and time in a different way. This fall, she's teaching a new course called Plagues, Pandemics, and People, Using Disease to Look at the Human Condition. She tells Ryan Denham the class will start by looking at the Black Death that hit Europe, Western Asia, and Northern Africa in the 1300s, as well as malaria. The effects on the body are just the start.
But then we'll get into, because I'm an anthropologist, more of the social effects. will talk about, for example, with the Black Death, how it didn't strike all parts of the population equally. People who were concentrated in cities were much harder hit. Poorer populations were much harder hit because they couldn't get away from other people, whereas people who could retreat to their country estates were spared to a larger extent.
With COVID, it is easy to wonder, you know, how much of this is permanent, you know, like Zoom meetings or hand washing or masks. Like, how much of this is going to be a permanent part of our lives after? And in history, I wonder if you can think of any examples of things that originated or spawned during a pandemic or a plague and then kind of lingered long after, something that became permanent.
Well, I mean, the idea of quarantine came out of various groups in I think Croatia trying to respond to the Black Death. So just, you know, the basic disease control comes out of that. But there's some people who argue that things like the Renaissance happened in Italy as a result of the Black Death, because people were seeing so much death and destruction around them that they became newly focused on spirituality and newly focused on patronizing the arts as a means of kind of understanding existence here on earth, but also tying themselves to a future, a heavenly future. So, I mean, I think that's not incontrovertible. There'd be arguments against that, but there's certainly people who say that something like the Renaissance is a direct result of the Black Death in Europe.
You know, with COVID, we are still very much learning how it interacts with the human body and, you know, who has antibodies, right, who's just not going to get it, who is really susceptible to it. So can you maybe go one level deeper on the evolutionary component to pandemics and plagues? I mean, the people who survive or who never get it, does that branch of our genetic line sort of carry on in a different way than those who perish or get sick?
Yeah, I mean, with a severe disease like something like the Black Death, it's a major selective event. And so it, you know, the 20% of people who survived those kinds of infections, they had some sort of different genetic variation compared to the rest of the population, at least many of them did. And so that genetic variation becomes more common in the population there. Thereafter, that, you know, it's kind of a founder effect of people who have this beneficial mutation of whatever sort, then are more common in the population and then spread it throughout the population. And in the case of malaria, we use resistance to malaria in the form of sickle cell trait as kind of the classic example of a disease acting on human populations as in terms of natural selection. So populations in parts of Africa that had high levels of endemic malaria developed this mutation, which is just a single change of one letter of the genetic code that led to this alternate form of the hemoglobin cells. And that led to resistance to malaria infections. Although the downside is that if you have two copies of that mutation, then you get sickle cell anemia, and which is a very deadly disease. So it's a good example that I use with my students in my introductory classes to talk about how evolution isn't perfect. It's not this march towards a more perfect form, because we have these selective events that lead to fixes that happen, so a way to survive malaria infections, but also can have huge downsides.
What is this moment in life like for an anthropologist, someone who kind of sees the arc of time in a bigger way than most of us do?
Well, I mean, I think it's reassuring, because you see that humans have survived through all of these different adverse events over time. I mean, it's scary in certain ways, because you see how big of a disruption a disease can be, or just, you know, any kind of events in human history can be. But humans have survived, and things have in many cases gotten better in certain ways, unexpected ways. And so I'm hopeful in certain ways that things can change. And the confluence of this current pandemic with the Black Lives Matter movement that's seeing a big moment right now, I feel optimistic that it could be a moment of truly profound transformation in our society. And we can see in the past that big transformations have happened in the as a result of these kind of upheavals. I also, though, you know, I have two kids and I have to remind myself to put on my anthropology hat, my archaeology hat, and think about the bigger picture, because most of the time I'm just exhausted and running after children and changing diapers and things like that. So
that's Illinois State University professor and archaeologist Abigail Stone speaking with Ryan Dunham about her new class this fall called Plagues, Pandemics, and People. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Political campaigning is a social endeavor, but like the rest of us, candidates have shifted to virtual platforms to connect with voters and get their message heard. Dana Vollmer talks to Illinois State University political scientist Kerry Melita about how holding rallies and town hall meetings has been working for those seeking election this November.
You might be surprised. Turnout at these virtual events has actually been not quite on par with an in-person rally, it's not nothing. There have actually been sizable turnout. And what's actually been neat is there's been a particular rise in turnout among what we would call marginalized voters, people that maybe are physically disabled, are battling an illness, or are hospitalized, and that would never be able to participate in political rallies are now being included. People that, you know, don't have transportation to these events or can't take time off of work. It's actually made for a significantly more inclusive campaign season, which is something that we didn't really anticipate.
National office campaigns generally have a lot of resources at their disposal and may be able to substitute some of this shoe weather that's not being done, at least not in person. But for races that are happening at a state or even county level, those door-to-door and community events tend to be a little bit more important in the turnout. So for those down-ballot races, what will this year look like for them, and how can they kind of make up some of that difference?
There is still an element of door-to-door that can be done, wearing masks and being distant. I've seen a number of local campaigns that they train their campaign workers to ring the doorbell and then step back, they're saying 8 to 12 feet, and have a conversation that way. So you can still do door-to-door, maintaining social distance. Of course, campaigns are relying a little bit more on literature, you know, that they leave on the doorstep than they have in years past. So it's changed the dynamic a bit, but it hasn't fundamentally altered the way you can go door to door. It's just kind of changed the procedures and how you train your campaign workers. They just have to be a little more considerate and mindful of the procedures.
When I think of like a 19th century race, we kind of think about newspaper endorsements and word of mouth being really prominent ways that candidates kind of get on the minds of voters. Are those things going to kind of come back to popularity this year?
Yeah, I mean, you know, things like endorsements, you know, it never really went away. It was just, I think, the amount of attention that we paid to it went away. And in times like this, where there's more of an information deficit because campaigns are trying to adapt into this new reality, which is probably going to be this way for at least a couple of years, if not indefinitely, it's maybe we have fewer shortcuts now to pay attention to. So maybe we start going back to endorsements as a way to help us figure out, you know, where candidates stand on the issues. But candidates still fill out questionnaires saying what their stances are on the key issues of the day. There's still going to be debates. They'll probably be virtual, or, I don't know, the podiums will be moved further apart without an audience. So I don't think that people will be struck with a lack of information on who they're going to vote for and how they're going to figure that out. But certainly some of these things that didn't matter, you know, as much might matter more moving to the future, like not just newspaper endorsements, but interest group endorsements as well.
And then how does the internet factor into all of this? This is obviously a direction that campaigns have been moving for a while, but is it especially important this year?
I think so. It's not that the pandemic changed campaigns. It's that the pandemic kind of sped up the trajectory that campaigns were already on, which was to become more virtual. And going virtual, it has a number of benefits for candidates. One is that it's cheaper. And, you know, the internet is this oddly level playing field. And what we've started to see is very much non-traditional candidates coming out of you know, the woodwork to run for office. Women, people of color, people that are very underrepresented in government, you know, now that campaigns are going online, going virtual, which is much cheaper, much more cost-effective and cost-efficient, it's kind of creating this weirdly level playing field for new types of candidates to emerge.
It sounds like you're not too concerned about the way that campaigns are being run necessarily impacting the outcome of a race, but something that may have a bigger impact would be voter turnout.
Yeah, I mean, definitely who turns out to vote impacts the fate of elections. It directly shapes election outcomes. Therefore, anything that can shape turnout shapes the election outcomes. Absolutely. And we don't know how this pandemic is going to play out. And it's going to vary state by state because the states are wildly different in how easy they're making it for people to cast their ballot without showing up in person and how accessible they're making that information to people. Almost certainly in-person turnout is going to be significantly lower. I mean, that's almost a given. It has to be. But what remains to be seen is how the expansion in absentee ballot voting, voting by mail, how that impacts the overall turnout numbers.
To hear more of Dana Vollmer's conversation with Illinois State University political scientist Carrie Melita, go to WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A preliminary look at fall enrollment numbers for Heartland Community College shows a drop of 8.6% in students and nearly that in credit hours. Heartland Vice President of Enrollment and Student Services Sarah Deal Hunt says the drop is in line with what is happening at other community colleges in the state and nation. Deal Hunt says there are pockets of students that have steeper enrollment declines, and there is one bright spot.
What we were pleased about is we enrolled a higher percentage of our continuing students from last spring. So once we get them here and they get to see the quality of our classes and what we can do, we can keep them. And so we were very pleased with that.
So what are the concerning areas? Are there specific courses of study like nursing or like, well, I don't know, what?
No, it's not in our programs. It's in our populations of student and in particularly vulnerable populations of students. Most concerning to me is that we saw, and these are unofficial tallies at this point, but first-generation college student enrollment for us is down 21%. And that's an audience we really serve, and we serve well. Also, underrepresented racial and ethnicity enrollment is down 16%, with the largest decline for us in our black student enrollment, which is down close to 30%. And so what we're seeing in those populations is they're just opting out this fall, either due to changes in their personal situations or due to the fact that they view this as a short-term situation. And perhaps they'll see a return to in-person classes next spring or fall.
So is that a money issue or a lack of internet issue or an administrative hoop-jumping issue because it's just flatly more difficult to get business done when it's not in person? Or what's your best guess on that?
I think it could be perceived, all of those things. The irony of it to me is that we've never been better situated to serve those students. We chose to target our governor's emergency relief funds directly to those populations to help them with tuition, to help them with technology, device, internet needs. We can even use them to erase a debt from the spring or summer term if they're carrying over a debt with us. We have more money than we've ever had before to be able to assist those students, and we have more supports than we've ever had. We have assistants set up to help students, assign them a coach, assign them a peer mentor to assist them in navigating the virtual world. So I think it's a perceived issue. Also, we do hear some that some of them experienced virtual learning in high school in the spring, which, as we all know, wasn't true to what virtual learning is. People had to do a crash course in it, but they didn't like it. And so they're going to wait and see if that doesn't return.
You would think that if it's the I don't like virtual learning as a strong thread in this, that that would affect all enrollment groups and not just these vulnerable populations or first-generation populations.
It could, but I think these populations are particularly vulnerable to that, particularly vulnerable to changes in their personal situations and just opting out. The other thing is, you know, we made our decision early, back in May, that we were going to go, you know, with everything virtual with the exception of the career technical courses that we really can't offer any other way. But I think we were out there for a reason. We went out there because we wanted our faculty to go prepare all summer and be prepared to teach those courses, and we wanted to have stability in what we were offering this fall. But I think by being out there earlier, we knew it might hurt.
Sarah Deal Hunt is the Vice President for Enrollment and Student Services at Heartland Community College. She says they will try a second big push at enrollment for courses that start after Labor Day. Formal fall enrollment numbers for colleges and universities come after the 10th day of classes. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas. Our website, WGLT.org, is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Eric Stock, Dana Vollmer, and Ryan Denham.